For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, Natalie Haynes explores the enduring appeal of Greek and Roman myth and launches her new novel, A Thousand Ships.
The Iliad does pass the Bechdel test. Two named women do have a conversation about something other than a man. It's Theano and Hecabe in book 6, and they discuss sacrificing to Athene. Spoiler, it's not going to work.
Jonathan Coe reveals how the characters of the Rotters Club have responded to Brexit.
The obvious thing to do was to try and write a novel which reflected these times, and that a good way to do that for me would be to go back to characters who I was already familiar with.
The author of The Belfry Witches conjures up the books of her life. I look back over 50 days that changed the world, and we bring you the winner of the Costa Book of the Year Award. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Natalie Haynes is passionate about the classics. Through her writing, broadcasting, and stand-up comedy, she shares her enthusiasm and knowledge of Greek and Roman legends with her legions of fans. Her latest novel, A Thousand Ships, is set during the Trojan War, and she narrated the audiobook herself. It proved to be an emotional experience, as I found out when she joined me in the studio. So, in A Thousand Ships, you set out to retell the Iliad from the point of view of its female characters.
Well, not just the Iliad, I guess. I wanted to tell the story of the whole Trojan War. So, the Iliad is actually one chapter. I only realised this myself about 2 weeks ago, something which I sort of that part I should have known a bit sooner. But there's a chapter on Briseis and Chryses, which is my version of the Iliad. But there are also recurring chapters about Penelope, which is my version of the Odyssey. And then there's the sort of causation of the war, which goes backwards in reverse order, and the consequences of the war, which goes forwards. And the consequences is a combination of Euripides' Trojan Women and Hecabe and a bunch of other plays. And the causation is a little bit more opaque. The Greek epic poems that told that story, the Kypria is the main one. It doesn't survive. We've only got a few tiny fragments of it. So it's sort of pieced together from lots of other places.
And there are many, many female characters in Greek myth. Helen, Athene, Aphrodite, and yet you were saying they have very, very few lines.
Well, it depends on the particular thing, I suppose. In the Iliad, for example, women have very little dialogue. It is a super masculine poem. It's about men fighting, essentially, over the city of Troy. And so Briseis, whose removal from Achilles, she's his war bride, and she's taken by Agamemnon and then returned to Achilles later, her having no agency is essentially the motivation for the entire 24-book epic poem. And she has 14 lines in book 19. Just to give you a sense of perspective, a few lines later, Achilles is getting ready to go into battle and he's preparing his horses. And he says, you know, you'll get me onto the battlefield, won't you, boys? And the goddess Hera enchants one of the horses to reply and the horse gets 10 lines. So the talking horse is very nearly as interesting. Anyway, the Iliad does pass the Bechdel test. Two named women do have a conversation about something other than a man. It's Theano and Hecabe in book 6, and they discuss sacrificing to Athene. Spoiler, it's not going to work. Never does. But the flip side of that is that of the 8 extant tragedies which Euripides wrote about the Trojan War, 7 of them have women as the title characters. So for Euripides, women are very much the place where the drama of the war happens. For Homer in the Iliad, then it's a very masculine story, a battlefield story. But for the Homer of the Odyssey, they're almost certainly two different poets, but who knows for sure. Then the Odyssey has many more, much more dramatic female characters, many more goddesses and monsters and sea monsters and all kinds of things.
And the goddesses are often as powerful or as influential as all but the top gods, Zeus.
Yes, and sometimes more powerful. The Moirai, the Fates, even Zeus can't go against. Famously, in book 16 of the Iliad, I'm glad we're doing an exam. In book 16 of the Iliad, Zeus' son Sarpedon is fighting and he's killed. Spoiler. He's killed by Patroclus in Patroclus's big push against the Trojans. And Zeus would rather that didn't happen. You know, it's his son. He would prefer his son to survive the war. But the Moirai, the Fates, have decreed that that's what's going to happen. And so that's what's going to happen. The whole war has only begun because Gaia, the earth goddess, can't cope with the weight of so many people. They've had a war before when there've been too many men. That's the Theban Wars. The most famous bit of that story to us is Oedipus. And then a few generations later comes the Trojan War because we've kind of populated her too heavily again and she's groaning under the weight. I think it's incredible that the sort of, I would guess, the earliest or certainly one of the earliest examples of population fear comes way, it just seems impossible to us now. You know, people go, oh, we've got X billion people and the planet can't cope. And you think, well, yes, that seems really plausible to me because, you know, look at the amount of resources that we use and look at this and look at that. But it is fascinating that people have been thinking that since the population was a fraction, a tiny fraction of what it is now.
Well, I was going to ask, what is the enduring fascination with the Greek myths? You're not the only author to have reimagined, both Pat Barker and Madeline Miller have recently.
Colin Tobin.
And they are as fresh nowadays, the stories, as they have been for 2.5 millennia.
I know, I always feel that too. And I had to discuss comparative mythology with somebody a couple of years ago, and they were defending Norse myth. And I thought there must be a reason why Greek myth is told and retold in a way that Norse myth simply isn't. If you look at things like the history of art in the West, then you can constantly see scenes of Greek myth. Zeus and Leda, for example, or the Judgment of Paris, as we tend to call it, although that seems to me to be focusing on the unnecessary man in the story rather than on the necessary goddesses, but the awarding of the golden apple to whichever goddess he chooses. Not a spoiler for once. And those paintings we can see over and over again, you know, or sculptures over and over again, but you don't find anywhere near as many paintings of, you know, Thor or Yggdrasil. And I think it's partly because they were Romanized, and obviously Latin becomes a very important language of Europe because of the Christian church. But it's partly because they speak to very real psychological conditions, which I just don't think you find so easily in other myth cycles that I know. You know, the Iliad, I think, in particular is fascinating because it offers so many versions of what it means to be a man, that it's an incredibly compelling document, quite aside from being an incredibly compelling poem. For me, the work of Euripides is the more foundational text because he offers so many extraordinary examples of what it means to be a woman in an oppressive society who simply disregards those oppressions with almost constant disaster and death.
I've always been struck by how blindness is treated in a very balanced way in Greek tragedy. It's not just punishment. It also can give insight.
Yes, it's a really interesting phenomenon, blindness, and particularly in the Oedipal story, because there is, of course, the most famous scene probably to us in Greek tragedy in that play, the Sophocles play, Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus the King, when Oedipus finally realises who he is, that he is the man who has killed the previous king of Thebes, that in so doing he has killed unknowingly his father and he has unknowingly married his own mother. And at that realisation, he is so appalled by what he sees that he has become, and he can no longer bear to see it, not to understand it, but to see it. And so famously, he takes the brooch pins from his hanged wife's dress and puts out his own eyes. So he ends the play blind. And it is the great irony of the play that only when he is blind does he truly see who he is and what he's done, and that when he finally sees that, he can no longer bear to see the light. And so there's certainly a sense of blindness there as a punishment, but it's a fascinating interplay of power because there is a much more potent sense, I think, that only at the point when he is blind is Oedipus, for want of a better phrase, fully rounded and aware man, because up to that point he's been living a lie. And what's interesting, of course, is that in a later play, Oedipus at Colonus, he has become this man whose death is a benediction. And what an extraordinary turnaround. I once tried to sell a book called Oedipus Died Happy. And I'm afraid I could never persuade anyone to buy it, about the idea that you could actually find lessons for your life to be sort of better by reading Greek tragedy. And I still vaguely think I should revive it as an idea. And of course, running through the Oedipus story is also Tiresias, the blind prophet, the man who can never see but can always see everything. And he is always guided by a child. And so this sense that being able to see with eyes is at most part of the story, and sometimes it's actually obstructive to being able to see the truth, being able to understand the truth. That runs all the way through Greek myth.
Yeah, the blind seer. It's a contradiction in terms.
I know, and I don't even hear that. You know, when I read it or say it, I don't hear the contradiction there at all because I'm so used to the idea of a seer being blind, which I know is crazy. But I think that's, again, that's one of those examples of Greek myth where it just seems so right. I was thinking this when the James Bond trailer came out, and it's like, oh, are you telling me the person's evil because they're facially disfigured? Again, the James Bond universe. What an interesting departure for you. And I thought, how interesting that Greek tragedy doesn't have that correlation at all. That, you know, Philoctetes isn't evil because he's got a bad foot. He's got a bad foot and it makes him bad tempered. So, but we understand that. And Tiresias, he's opaque because he chooses to be. It's not because he can't be, you know, so he can see, but he won't always share. And so he does have an insight that the rest of us can't always access.
And famously, Homer was supposedly blind as well.
Perhaps, yeah. The Odyssey is full of bards. And one of the things I love about the Odyssey, actually, is that it's full of rhapsode or bards who basically go around kind of being treated really well or really badly. And you kind of get the sense that the composer of the Odyssey is going, hey, guys, I would like some extra wine and meat if that's all right. And so look at how nicely this character is behaving with extra wine and meat for the rhapsode. But there's a bard in the Odyssey called, I think, Demodocus. There are a bunch. And Demodocus, I think, is blind. And so there's a suggestion that this is sort of an authorial trick, that it's Homer referring to himself. In my book, I made Homer blind, but I don't name him because it was a little hat tip to the fact that in the first line of the Iliad, he doesn't name the goddess, the muse. So I thought, this will be adorable. I'll have Homer, but I won't ever say that it's Homer. But I think probably most people haven't noticed. So another of my in-jokes goes famously flat.
You narrated the audiobook version yourself. Was that fun?
It was, actually, and I'd always said no to it before. This is the first of them I'd done. And they asked me if I would do The Children of Jocasta a couple of years ago, and I said no because that has two narrative strands. One is third person, Jocasta, which I felt I probably could do, and the other is first person, is Mani, and she's sort of 14, 15. And I was like, dude, it's sweet of you to ask, but I'm 200 years old. I can't sound like a teenager. But with Ships, A Thousand Ships has so many different characters, multiple narrators. And so I thought, well, that's okay. Nobody can do it in a way. Nobody's got the right age voice for all of those women. And so I might as well do it as anyone else. So yeah, it was an incredibly... I don't normally read things once I've finished them. I read them the whole time I'm writing them. I read them aloud. I read them the whole time I'm editing aloud. I think the sound of sentences is something... I was astonished to find out everyone didn't do it. You know, it's one of those things where you sort of casually say in a group of writers and everyone looks at you like you've fallen from a tree and you're like, why isn't everyone doing this? It really helps. You know, you can put as many subordinate clauses in a sentence if you want, but if you can't say it, mate, how is anyone else ever going to?
Obviously, the stories are originally from an oral tradition. Yes. So I suppose you're returning to the source in that respect.
Absolutely. Yeah, why not? And that's why I like having a live show that kind of goes with the book. And the live show generally is fun, like the radio shows are. Well, at least they're intended to be. The books usually are more serious and more sad. So, yeah, I like the idea of performing around the book, but doing the actual reading of the audiobook, I don't know, it was such an emotional book to write because some of it is lots of fun and some of it was incredibly harrowing. Actually, the most upsetting bit for me is the Andromache bit of the Trojan Women chapter, but I won't give it away because I don't want to make everyone else sad. And I cried when I wrote it and I cried when I edited it and I cried when I read it. And I thought they would make me retake it. And they were like, no, it's fine, it's good. And I was like, okay. And when I was writing it, it felt like it would, you know, fall over and topple over onto me and crush me. And then when you actually come to it, it's like two pages or something. I was like, how is it possible this huge thing can be so tiny? But anyway.
What was the first text that opened your eyes to the classics?
Probably the Aeneid, actually. It's probably a Roman text because I had Aeneid 2 at GCSE, which is the Fall of Troy. That's the Creusa chapter of my book. And it is such a remarkable book of poetry. Because it's sort of, it's the great action movie sequence, the city on fire, man trying to escape with his child and his wife disappears and it's, you know, thrilling. And also Creusa gets nothing to do apart from be a ghost. And so I was determined, even I think at 15, I guess I must have been when I read that, I thought, well, this isn't acceptable. This woman's story needs to be told. And then at A-level, I got Aeneid 4, which is Dido and Aeneas. And Dido is probably the most extraordinary character for me anyway in the entire Aeneid. I think her story is so potent and beautiful. I can still quote huge chunks of it in Latin and English any way you want because I'm memorizing it for all those exams, but also because it's just beautiful. And then at the same time, I was doing A-level Greek and my dad had driven me down to London to see Diana Rigg play Medea at the Almeida. And it is no exaggeration to say that that simply changed my life. I have never stopped reading or thinking about Greeks or Euripides or women in tragedy. I've, you know, reviewed theatre for the last 15-something years, something like that. And all of it probably stems to that production where she finally reveals the bodies of her dead children to Jason by smashing the metal wall at the back of the Almeida and these two huge metal plates fell down and revealed their bodies and the crash and the sound of that metal on metal. I have never been the same again.
I saw the same production, yeah. And yes, it's the most amazing coup de théâtre I think I've ever witnessed, and it stays with you. And that's the power of Greek tragedy. You never forget the plays.
Yeah, it is. And also that they can take almost any amount of retelling, of reimagining, of moving through time and space, and they'll be fine. Somebody asked me this when the book came out, and they said, you know, do you think there's a danger that these things seem irrelevant or go out of date? And I was like, I would love the Trojan women to be irrelevant. Are you kidding me? There's nothing I would like more than the suppliants or the Troades to be irrelevant. Imagine if we didn't ever need a play again about women migrants desperately trying to find assistance from a male ruler because they're on the run from forced marriage. I would love that to be true. Imagine if we never again needed a play where women are enslaved at the end of a war and treated horrifically by the men who killed their husbands and children. Imagine. Yeah, great. I'll sign up for that. I'm happy. I'll get another job. Not yet, though.
And who's going to receive your attention after A Thousand Ships?
The next book is nonfiction, and it's called Pandora's Jar. And it's a study of, I think it's going to turn out to be 10 women from Greek myth whose stories have been distorted and changed from their earliest representations right the way through to now.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you'll come back and tell us all about it.
I might move in.
And hopefully narrate the audiobook.
Yes, please. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Natalie Haynes, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
A deafening crack awoke her and she caught her breath. She looked around for the baby before remembering that he was no longer a baby, but had seen 5 summers come and go while the war raged outside the city walls. He was in his own room, of course he was. Her breathing slowed, and she waited to hear him cry out for his mother, terrified by the thunderstorm. But the cry did not come. He was brave, her little boy. Too brave to cry out as a lightning bolt, even if it was hurled by Zeus himself. She wrapped the coverlet over her shoulders and tried to guess what hour of the night it was. The pitter-patter of rain was growing louder. It must be early morning, because she could see across the room. But the light was peculiar, a fat yellow colour which caught the dark red walls and painted them an ugly, bloody shade. How could the light be so yellow unless the sun was rising? And how could the sun fill her rooms when she could hear the rain falling on the roof? Disorientated by her recent dreams, it was several moments before she realised the acrid tang was in her nostrils, not her imagination. The crash had not been thunder, but a more earthly destruction. The pitter-patter was not rain, but the sound of dried wood and straw crackling in the heat. And the flickering yellow light was not the sun.
A Thousand Ships, written and narrated by Natalie Haynes, is out now wherever you buy your books. And hopefully it'll be sailing into the RNIB library soon, where it will join Natalie's Ancient Guide to Modern Life, which is TB 703729, her novel Amber Fury, and her book for children, The Great Escape. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we reveal the winner of the 2019 Costa Book of the Year Award and find out which books inspired Kate Saunders to become an author. And I brush up on my history. But before that, Jonathan Coe first came to prominence with his novel What a Carve-Up. Then, in 2001, he introduced us to The Rotters Club, a funny and poignant tale of growing up in 1970s Birmingham. Middle England, the third book in the series, brings his characters right up to date and confronts them with Brexit. The book won the Costa Novel Award, with the judges describing it as the perfect novel for our time. RNIB Connect Radio's Hannah Tauss was keen to find out more.
First of all, congratulations on winning the Costa Novel of the Year Award, although you're no stranger to winning prizes. Does it become any less exciting or flattering?
Well, in point of fact, I haven't won that many prizes in my own country. I've won prizes in France and Italy and Spain, but it's actually getting on for 20 years since I think I won a British prize for one of my novels. So it's very, very pleasing indeed.
Middle England follows the characters introduced in The Rotters Club and The Close Circle, although Middle England itself can be easily read as a standalone. Was it comforting to return to characters you knew, or challenging to move them on in their lives?
Comforting is a very good word, really. There were two things going on in my mind at the same time when I conceived this book early in 2016. Part of me wanted to revisit the characters from The Rotters Club because I was getting curious about how they were dealing with life in their 50s. Part of me also could see that in the build-up to the Brexit referendum, Britain was undergoing a period of some kind of upheaval and change. And it suddenly occurred to me that these two ideas could really be the same idea, and that the obvious thing to do was to try and write a novel which reflected these times, and that a good way to do that for me would be to go back to characters who I was already familiar with, so they could be my kind of anchor and my guide through a very rapidly changing political landscape.
Middle England is being dubbed the Brexit book, but actually starts in 2010. What made you decide to begin from that particular date?
Well, it's a book about the roots of Brexit, really. It climaxes about two-thirds of the way through with the referendum vote itself. So most of the book is concerned with the build-up to that. And yeah, it was tricky to know where to start, in a way. The 2008 financial crisis could have been an obvious starting point. Mm-hmm. I also think that the 2009 politicians' expenses scandal, which was covered so extensively in the papers, was a very significant moment for breaking down people's trust in politicians generally on both sides. And then in 2010, of course, we had the election of a coalition government for the first time, and a real sense that the British people, offered a choice between Conservative and Labour, couldn't really make their minds up and were kind of equally unenthusiastic about both. So the election of the coalition government was my chosen starting point in the end. And there was also that very significant moment in the 2010 election when Gordon Brown was caught on a microphone describing one of his supporters as a bigoted woman because she'd raised a question about immigration. And I thought that was a very interesting moment, not just because of what the discussion was about, but also because it was a chance, a kind of tiny chance incident, an accident, a moment of carelessness, which had a profound historical effect. And I'm very drawn to the theory of history as a series of tiny accidents which can have momentous consequences.
Going back to what you said previously, Nigel, who works for the government in communications, calls the spirit of the times in 2010 as one of radical indecision. Mm. How accurate do you think, personally, his description is?
Well, of course, I take the mickey out of Nigel mercilessly with his constant kind of parroting of government lines and that kind of thing. But I actually think he's onto something there. Because, as I say, that was the first moment for me when I thought that actually, faced with all the political choices that the present system offers them, the British public is finding it very hard to make up their minds between one or the other. And that, to me, is the truth of the referendum result as well, because people talk about the will of the people, sometimes the overwhelming will of the people. And in fact, 52-48, in any rational scheme of things, is a don't-know answer. And that was really what people were saying in 2016, I think, that they didn't really know what they wanted their future relationship with the EU to be. Of course, it's the way things have panned out in the last 3.5 years, that's been turned into a very radical mandate for quite a hard Brexit. But I don't think it ever really was that. I think it was more an expression of confusion and indecision than anything else.
Brexit has been particularly divisive, and in the book it certainly causes some marital woes. Did you witness this at all in your own family and friends?
Certainly among my friends, yes. My family, we're not the kind of family that talks about politics very much to each other, really, or indeed about anything. But with my friends, yes. I've lost one friendship, really, over Brexit, and others have been damaged. And I find this very interesting, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to write a novel about it, because what is this about this question, which on paper looks like a rather dry political question, do you want to be a member of this particular trading bloc or not? And a question which in 2014, say, most people couldn't really care less about. But what was it about that question which got people so animated, so passionate, and so divided? And I think, you know, without realizing it, because he approached the whole referendum thing rather carelessly, in my opinion, but without realizing, David Cameron actually asked us a very profound question about identity, about what we felt our relationship to our own country was, about what we felt our country's relationship to other countries should be, about what kind of country we wanted to be. It really cut right to the fundamentals of our sense of national identity, which is also our sense of personal identity. It's not just like voting Tory or voting Labour, because you have couples who are on either side of that divide and they tend to rub along okay, but leave or remain is a much more profound divide than that, I think.
Yes.
And people talk rather glibly at the moment about bringing the country together and rallying around and getting on with Brexit and so on. And I don't think it's going to be that simple, because the bitterness from that referendum and how it panned out will last for many years, if not decades.
There's a lot of nostalgia in the book, particularly from Benjamin. Are you going through a similar period of reflection?
I think I finally emerged from my nostalgia period. Temperamentally, I always have been quite a nostalgic person. Since I was very young, actually. I mean, my parents used to remind me that even when I was 11 or 12, I was already intensely nostalgic for when I was 7 or 8. So nostalgia has been an ingrained habit of mine for me for a long time. But I've felt just recently, as I'm coming into the second half of my 50s, that I'm not so interested in that anymore. And I've also started to notice that in many ways, nostalgia is a dangerous sentiment.
Yes.
And particularly when it gets politicized. And we talk a lot about the nostalgia of Brexiters and how, you know, maybe they look back nostalgically towards the spirit of the Blitz and the heyday of empire and this kind of thing. But there's also a nostalgia of the left as well. And that's what Benjamin is subject to in this novel. He looks back very longingly towards the 1970s, which were his teenage years, and a time when he felt the country felt more cohesive. Yes. But actually, as is pointed out to him in the last chapter by a young Pakistani woman, this would have been a terrible time for me to be a teenage Pakistani woman in the UK. I wouldn't want to go back to that. So we're all subject to false nostalgia, I think. And politicians, populist politicians, are getting very good at weaponizing that.
Yes.
You see that with Trump. You see that with Marine Le Pen. Looking back towards a supposed halcyon golden age is a very dangerous thing, I think.
Now, one of the subjects you cover is the issue of political correctness gone too far, introducing the rather loathsome teenager Coriander. Did your children help create her in any way?
Well, you know, I try to be a fairly progressive, liberal parent, but even then I find the generation gaps are inevitable and there are some issues that the generations just think about differently. And one of the ways in which the younger generation, my daughter's generation, are perhaps ahead of my generation is in their thinking about gender, because some quite radical new ideas about gender have become mainstream among young people in the last few years, and my generation is struggling, I think, to catch up with that. So in that sense, that strand of the story was inspired by my daughters, although in terms of personality, they're very different to Coriander. In my view, it's not that political correctness has gone too far, but there can be a problem with the way political correctness is policed and enforced. And the character in my novel, Sophie, is a very liberal, open-minded person who happens to make an unfortunate, nervous joke about a trans student. And what's unfortunate about what happens to her is not that she gets into trouble for it, because in a way she should get into trouble for it, but the speed and the violence and the uncompromising nature of what happens, you know, the immediate Twitter storm, the immediate suspension this kind of thing. It's not so much a comment upon political correctness per se, but on the rush to judgment that we have in this country at the moment, the desire to rush to an absolute opinion about something. And if you deviate from that in the slightest, then you're a pariah.
But very touchingly resolved in the end.
Yes. Well, you know, it's quite a gentle book, I feel, in some ways. And one of the first people who read it was one of my closest friends, and I thought that he would talk to me about the treatment of Brexit, about the return of the Rotters Club characters and so on. But the first thing he said was, actually, this is your kindest book for a long time, because it actually shows people, in the end, trying to be nice to each other and trying to get along and trying to bury their differences. And I suppose that's true. Maybe I'm mellowing in old age.
Now, you have the wonderful Rory Kinnear narrating the audiobook. Did you have anything to do with choosing him?
Yeah, I did, because he also read, there was an audiobook of my previous novel, Number 11, which is a novel told in two voices, one male, one female. So he did the male voice in that, and that was Penguin's choice. But he did such a fantastic job that when they asked me if I had any thoughts about who should do the audiobook, I said, please, 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 can we get Rory Kinnear back, because he's just a fantastic reader. And I have to say that I don't reread my own books. Once they're finished, then I like to try to forget about them and move on to the next. But out of curiosity, when I was making quite a long car journey, I put on the audiobook of Middle England just to see how it sounded, thinking I would give it 10 minutes. And I was actually laughing at my own jokes for the first time, because Rory just made it so much funnier and so much livelier than I thought it was on the page. So I'm actually advising people to experience it as an audiobook anyway, because I think the audiobook is better than the printed version, thanks to him.
Well, our audience is certainly very appreciative of the,
of course, yeah,
the Costa Prize making it available for our listeners or readers. Do you have any links to Sight Loss yourself?
Not directly in my personal or family life, but I did write a novel in the form of audio description. So I wrote a novel about 15 years ago called The Rain Before It Falls. And the way it's told is in the form of 20 photographs which are being described in great detail to a blind listener. So that's my main contact with sight loss as a kind of literary device.
A slightly off-the-wall question for you. You are brilliant at writing normalised sex scenes. Is it easier to write a book about Brexit or to write a sex scene with a straight face?
Probably easier to write a book about Brexit. The sex scene in Middle England was not meant to be as absurd or as crazy as it pans out. I actually wanted to write rather a tender and truthful scene of physical love between two people in their late 50s. But as I wrote it, it got more and more comic and more absurd, and I decided to run with that. And of course, it's also complicated by the fact that these two people were also lovers as teenagers. So it's really a commentary on how different sex can be between when you're 17 and when you're 57.
It took me back marvellously to What a Carve Up, when the writer's publisher says that he has to put in the sex scene. And
yes,
he's desperately trying to find the right words.
It is difficult. I mean, I've had a crack in several books at writing serious sex scenes. I don't know with what degree of success, but I think my comic ones are usually more enjoyable for the reader and the writer, actually.
Well, Jonathan Coe, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations once again.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure talking to you as well.
The funeral was over. The reception was starting to fizzle out. Benjamin decided it was time to go.
Dad, he said, I think I'm going to make a move.
Good, said Colin. I'll come with you.
They headed for the door and managed to escape without saying any goodbyes. The village street was deserted, silent in the late sunshine.
We shouldn't really just leave like this, said Benjamin, glancing back towards the pub doubtfully.
Why not? I've spoken to everyone I want to. Come on, take me to the car.
Benjamin allowed his father to hold him by the arm in a faltering grip. He was steadier on his feet that way. With indescribable slowness, they began to shuffle along the street towards the pub car park.
I don't want to go home, said Colin. I can't face it. without her. Take me to your place.
Sure, said Benjamin, even as his heart plummeted. The vision he had been promising himself, solitude, meditation, a cold glass of cider at the old wrought-iron table, the murmur of the river as it rippled by on its timeless course, disappeared, spiralled away into the afternoon sky. Never mind. His duty today was to his father.
Would you like to stay the night?
Yes, I would, said Colin, but he didn't say thank you. He rarely did these days.
Rory Kinnear narrating Middle England by Jonathan Coe. Thanks to Jonathan Coe and to Hannah Tauss. A wide selection of books by Jonathan Coe, including The Rotters Club and Middle England, is available from the RNIB Library. For more information, search the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, we reveal which of the five titles in contention has been crowned Costa Book of the Year 2019. But first, here at the audiobook show, we love a good recommendation. Whether it's an old favourite or a new title that you've found in the library, you can email us via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. And hearing Natalie Haynes and Jonathan Coe talking about momentous events reminded me of an educating read suggestion I received. In Days That Changed the World, Howell Williams sets out to examine 2,500 years of human history by identifying 50 world-changing events. It's no mean feat. He starts in ancient Greece at the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. There, the heavily outnumbered Greeks halted the advancing Persian Empire. On that day, he argues, the balance of world power was changed forever, and the seeds of Western culture were sown.
The Battle of Salamis became the first great sea battle to be described in recorded history. It was a momentous event in the long story of the wars between the Greeks and the Persian Empire. The Greek fleet was able to defeat the much larger Persian navy at the Straits of Salamis, located between the island of Salamis and the Athenian port of Piraeus. In 480 BC, the Persian army, led by King Xerxes I, had conquered large parts of Greece. The Persian navy, consisting of 1,000 galleys, was threatening to surround and overwhelm the Greek fleet of 370 triremes located in the Saronic Gulf. The eventual victory was the result of some clever Greek trickery, a quality which was always a cause for Hellenic self-congratulation. The Greek commander Themistocles sent Xerxes a false message, suggesting that he was preparing to change sides. Lured by the Greeks, the Persians then sailed into the narrow waters of the Salamis Straits, where the Greek triremes proceeded to launch a ferocious attack, ramming the Persian ships and sinking some 300 of them. The Greeks, by contrast, lost only about 40 of their ships. The remainder of the Persian fleet had to withdraw, and Xerxes was forced to postpone any further land campaigns for a year. This provided the Greeks with a crucial breathing space, during which the autonomous city-states, Polais, set aside their customary quarrels. Their united armies, under the command of the Spartan general Pausanias, went on to defeat the Persians at the Battle of Plataea in 479 BC.
In the chapters that follow, Williams makes a whistle-stop tour through 2,500 years of human history, culminating with 9/11, the day on which the current crisis between Western and Middle Eastern powers exploded into public consciousness. As he admits himself in the introduction, it's an inevitably Western-centric point of view, and much of the book is concerned with people, particularly Europeans, pushing out beyond their borders. Many of the days he selects occur when opposing forces collide, resulting in massive social upheaval. So we have the fall of Constantinople, the Battle of Waterloo, the first day of the Somme, and Hiroshima. However, the stuff of history is not just to be found on the battlefield. Some of the days he selects represent the beginning of something that only becomes apparent later on. So we also have events that lit the fuse of religious revolution, such as the crucifixion and Martin Luther's appearance at the Diet of Worms, and of political revolution, such as the coronation of Charlemagne and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. There are also examples of intellectual contribution, such as Newton's first day at university and the publication of Einstein's special theory of relativity. And there are social catalysts, such as the opening of the Liverpool to Manchester railway, Alexander Graham Bell's application for a patent for the telephone, and the moon landing. On the whole, I think Williams chose his days well. The book is a nice balance of social, political, and military history. He devotes a short chapter to each event, summarising what happened on the day and putting it into context. And then he feeds it into the wider narrative that single events have the power to affect world history. In presenting his days in chronological order, Williams gives a sense of the increasing speed and range of their impact. By contrast, the human factors behind them remain the same. Mankind has always fought bitterly for power and resources, while also being inventive, resilient, and compassionate.
Luther's rebellion started as a question of theology and church government, but it had inevitable political consequences. In his polemic against the papacy, Luther was supported by his local prince, Frederick the Wise, Elector of Saxony. Frederick, like many other German princes, thought the issues raised were so important that the reformer should explain his case to the Diet. This enraged the papacy, which thought the Diet should be automatically supportive of its case. But by now the reform movement had become a popular movement, stirring powerful, sometimes anti-Italian nationalism. Having escaped the confines of the university, the court, the church and the monastery, it had now taken to the streets. Which is why, when Luther entered Worms, a troop of German knights accompanied him, and the town was filled with his supporters. He appeared before Charles V at the session of the Diet which met on the 17th of April. When asked to recant, he asked for a day to consider. The following afternoon, he had a bigger audience before him since the Diet was meeting in a larger hall. Luther now delivered his reply in a prepared speech. He would only recant if he became convinced of his own error, either by reason or by scripture. He was guided, he said, by his conscience, and every human being's conscience was bound by the word of God. The Diet dissolved in confusion, with the Catholic theologian Johann Eck and Luther shouting at each other. Luther probably did not say, "Here I stand, I can do no other," but the phrase became famous because it really did sum up his position. He is the hero, therefore, not only of the Protestant Reformation, but of the voice of the stubborn individual conscience.
The risk of any book like this is that, in condensing so much information, the writing becomes a list of facts that are glued together by a single, repetitive argument. Williams has an engaging style that's narrated mellifluously by Gordon DeLieu and Charlotte Strevens, and I came away feeling that I'd learned a lot of very interesting facts, but I'm not sure how well they'll stick. The thing is, it's the kind of book that you dip in and out of. There's simply too much info to take in at once. If I could still see, I'd have a paperback copy crammed with post-it notes and scribbles in the margin. On audiobook, despite being well narrated, the flow of facts sometimes became a flood that turned the book into a lecture. But overall, this was a very educative, educating read suggestion. Days That Changed the World by Howell Williams is TB15406. Now, before we hear which books have inspired the creator of the Belfry Witches, it's time to reveal which title has won the 2019 Costa Book of the Year Award. If you listened to last week's show, you'll know that the five category winners in contention were The Confessions of Franny Langton by Sarah Collins, which won the Debut Novel Award, The Volunteer, The True Story of the Resistance Hero Who Infiltrated Auschwitz, written by Jack Fairweather, which won the Costa Biography Award, Flesh by Mary Jean Chan, which won the Poetry Award, Asher and the Spirit Bird by Jasbinder Bilan, which won the Costa Children's Award, and, of course, Middle England by Jonathan Coe, the winner of the Best Novel Award, and the winner of the overall 2019 Costa Book of the Year Award is The Volunteer by Jack Fairweather. This is the incredible true story of Witold Pilecki, the Polish resistance hero who infiltrated Auschwitz in the summer of 1940. At the time, it was a concentration camp for Polish political prisoners, and Witold's job was to gather intelligence. However, over the next 3 years, he led a resistance group from inside the camp that organised escapes, set up a radio station, and even carried out assassinations. He was an early witness to the extermination of the Jews and begged the Allies to bomb Auschwitz, but his pleas fell on deaf ears. His eventual escape and the fate that he suffered at the hands of the Russians just add more excitement and poignancy to the tale. The chair of the Costa judges, Sean Williams, said, "It's pacey like a thriller. It has the tension and colour of fiction, but it's fact." And she urged everyone to read it. Coming the day after the world marked the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, Jack Fairweather said, "This is the story of a man who had the courage to resist the worst of humanity, which is something we should all learn from." The audiobook is available commercially and is beautifully and compellingly narrated by David Rintoul.
The prisoners of Auschwitz also struggled to imagine the scope of the Holocaust as the Germans transformed the camp from a brutal prison to a death factory. They too succumbed to the human impulse to ignore or rationalise or dismiss the mass murders as separate from their own struggle. Yet Witold did not. Instead, he staked his life on bringing the camp's horror to light.
Congratulations to Jack Fairweather for winning the 2019 Costa Book of the Year Award with The Volunteer, the true story of the resistance hero who infiltrated Auschwitz. You can find a more in-depth interview about the book and all the category winners from this and previous year's Costa Awards by subscribing to our podcast. Simply go to the rnibconnectradio.org.uk website or your favourite podcast provider and search for Read On, the audiobook show. And finally, Kate Saunders is a best-selling author whose Belfry Witches series has delighted generations of children. Her latest book, The Land of Never Endings, was shortlisted for last year's Philip Carnegie Medal. You can find my interview with her by searching the website rnibconnectradio.org.uk or downloading the podcast. But here, for the first time ever, are the books of her life. Kate, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Look, narrowing this down to just three is virtually impossible because there were lots of books that I adored. I would say my top three were, well, Five Children and It, you won't be surprised to hear that, by E. Nesbitt, which I wrote a book called Five Children on the Western Front, which was a continuation of that. I loved Nesbitt's work as a child, and I didn't think of her as Edwardian at all. I loved her tone, I loved the way she spoke to me and wrote for me, and I think she's just been a vast influence on all children's writers since her. She sort of is the mother of the modern children's book, and is still appealing now. I read her books to my son when he was little, and they came up as fresh as paint, despite the kind of Edwardiana around them.
The house was 3 miles from the station, but before the dusty hired fly had rattled along for 5 minutes, the children began to put their heads out of the carriage window and to say, "Aren't we nearly there?" And every time they passed a house, which was not very often, they all said, "Oh, is this it?" But it never was, till they reached the very top of the hill, just past the chalk quarry, and before you come to the gravel pit. And then there was a white house with a green garden and an orchard beyond, and Mother said, "Here we are." "How white the house is," said Robert. "And look at the roses," said Anthea. "And the plums," said Jane. "It is rather decent," Cyril admitted. The baby said, "Want you go walkie?" And the fly stopped with a last rattle and jolt. Everyone got its legs kicked or its feet trodden on in the scramble to get out of the carriage that very minute, but no one seemed to mind. Mother, curiously enough, was in no hurry to get out, and even when she had come down slowly and by the step and with no jump at all, she seemed to wish to see the boxes carried in, and even to pay the driver, instead of joining in that first glorious rush round the garden and the orchard and the thorny, thistly, briary, brambly wilderness beyond the garden gate and the dry fountain at the side of the house. But the children were wiser, for once. It was not really a pretty house at all. It was quite ordinary, and Mother thought it was rather inconvenient and was quite annoyed at there being no shelves to speak of and hardly a cupboard in the place. Father used to say that the ironwork on the roof and coping was like an architect's nightmare. But the house was deep in the country, with no other house in sight, and the children had been in London for 2 years without so much as once going to the seaside, even for a day, by an excursion train. And so the white house seemed to them a sort of fairy palace set down in an earthly paradise. For London is like prison for children, especially if their relations are not rich.
Elizabeth Proud narrating Five Children and It by Edith Nesbit, which is TB2437. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Book two is a very girly book that influenced me, and it's Noel Stretfield's Ballet Shoes, which little girls who are a bit stage-struck still love. I was stage-struck. I don't blame Noel Stretfield for making me go on the stage when I was younger. That was entirely my own fault. It's a wonderful book, you know, and God, it stands up so well. Wouldn't give it to boys, but girls adore it.
Pauline, Petrova and Posy had a very ordinary nursery life. Not a great many toys, because they had no relations to give them any. There was a good deal of passing down of clothes, because there was not a great amount of money, and no one knew when Gum would be back to provide any more. "It does seem mean, Nana," Sylvia said. "Posy never gets any new clothes at all, and Petrova hardly any, while Pauline has them all the time." "Ah, well," Nana looked proudly at Pauline. "So it is in a good many nurseries, and I must say if anyone's going to have them, it's a good thing it's her. Pauline does pay for dressing." So Pauline did. By the time she was 4, she was really lovely. A mass of almost white curls, huge blue eyes, and the sort of pink and white look seen in the best babies. Sylvia secretly admired Petrova more. She thought she looked interesting. She was too pale and too thin, but she had deep-set brown eyes and hair the colour of a jay's wing. Posy, at 2, suddenly surprised everybody by becoming red-headed. Up till then, she had very little hair, and that mostly mouse-coloured. But one morning, a little red showed, and then after a week or two, she was quite decidedly ginger.
Beth Chalmers narrating Ballet Shoes by Noel Stretfield, which is TB15621. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Book three will surprise nobody. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, which I love now. I think it is a masterpiece. I absolutely love everything about it and often wish that I could have tea with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who are my favourite characters.
She stayed behind because she thought it would be worthwhile trying the door of the wardrobe, even though she felt almost sure that it would be locked. To her surprise, it opened quite easily, and 2 mothballs dropped out. Looking into the inside, she saw several coats hanging up, mostly long fur coats. There was nothing Lucy liked so much as the smell and feel of fur. She immediately stepped into the wardrobe and got in among the coats and rubbed her face against them, leaving the door open, of course, because she knew that it is very foolish to shut oneself into any wardrobe. Soon she went further in and found that there was a second row of coats hanging up behind the first one. It was almost quite dark in there, and she kept her arms stretched out in front of her so as not to bump her face into the back of the wardrobe. She took a step further in, then two or three steps, always expecting to feel woodwork against the tips of her fingers. But she could not feel it. "This must be a simply enormous wardrobe," thought Lucy, going still further in and pushing the soft folds of the coats aside to make room for her. Then she noticed that there was something crunching under her feet. "I wonder, is that more mothballs?" she thought, stooping down to feel it with her hand. But instead of feeling the hard, smooth wood of the floor of the wardrobe, she felt something soft and powdery and extremely cold. "This is very queer," she said, and went on a step or two further. Next moment, she found that what was rubbing against her face and hands was no longer soft fur, but something hard and rough and even prickly. "Why, it is just like branches of trees!" exclaimed Lucy. And then she saw that there was a light ahead of her, not a few inches away where the back of the wardrobe ought to have been, but a long way off. Something cold and soft was falling on her. A moment later, she found that she was standing in the middle of a wood at night time, with snow under her feet and snowflakes falling through the air. Lucy felt a little frightened, but she felt very inquisitive and excited as well. She looked back over her shoulder, and there, between the dark tree trunks, she could still see the open doorway of the wardrobe, and even catch a glimpse of the empty room from which she had set out. She had, of course, left the door open, for she knew that it is a very silly thing to shut oneself into a wardrobe.
Michael York narrating The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, which is TB1653. Kate Saunders, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of books with Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. That's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. And don't forget our podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate and review the show. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On.